Thank you for listening this afternoon. We begin the program with Pentagon Solutions today. Every Wednesday in the 4 o'clock hour, we look at the challenges the Pentagon is dealing with and hear voices from both inside and outside the building about how to deal with those challenges. My guest today is Steve Grundman. He is the Lund Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Principal at Grundman Advisory. Steve, it is great to have you here. You've been on the program a number of times by phone. It's good to see you in the studio today. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Francis. I'm pleased to be here.
You are launching a speaker series called The Captains of Industry, and this is a particularly timely episode today because of where we are right now, day two of a government shutdown, and we're seeing the impact on the Department of Defense and the other departments inside the federal government. But the result for the contracting community is a lot less clear. You had Dave Melcher, the CEO of Excellus, there today, obviously a long career in the military. Set the stage for me as far as your perception of where the defense industrial base is, what they're thinking about today.
Sure. Well, as Dave Melcher himself remarked this morning in the launch event of this Captains of Industry series that we have undertaken, to some degree, the industry is in a little bit of a holding pattern right now, owing most directly to the fact that the long-term outlook on defense spending is so completely clouded. And so that ripples through to a whole bunch of decisions, not the least of which is employment decisions, investment decisions that they may otherwise be making in new products and services that they could bring to the customer, but they're not sure if there's a customer, you know, out there 3 and 4 and 5 years from now to buy these things. And it also, most especially from a corporate strategic perspective, has put a damper on mergers and acquisitions that otherwise might be undertaken to restructure the industry in the light of this downturn in defense.
The M&A angle of that is one I want to come back to, but the title of this was The Business of Defense in an Age of Austerity, Perspectives from the Mid-Tier. It strikes me that the complexities that somebody like Dave Melcher and his colleagues at other companies are looking at is about three layers. One of them, obviously, is the shutdown, and that's what you've got to deal with today and the next couple of weeks, hopefully sooner rather than later. The next one is sequestration, however long that lasts and whatever that looks like. And then the third layer is just a general smaller budget, and that's pretty much as far as the eye can see. Is that the lay of the land, the way that they're looking at it in your sense?
You know, while I agree with you that these fiscal issues, these budget issues are at the forefront, I will admit that one of the things I found most interesting about Dave Melcher's presentation this morning is that the money, let's call it, to put a caption on it, is not actually at the forefront of the strategic challenge that his company faces, at least the way I heard it. I should let him speak for himself, of course, but the way I heard it, you know, for example, let me just pick off two things that I made notes of that I wasn't so much expecting to hear. One was that in many ways, the strategic challenge facing the defense industry is driven as much by changes in how and what the customers want as it is how much money they've got.
Hmm.
You know, he talked about how what they want is moving from what he called land-centric to commons-centric. He talked about how there would be very few new starts, but instead a customer that wanted to extend and customize platforms that they already have in hand. Sure, he talked about lower resources, but he also talked about, for example, as you and I have discussed in the past, the Better Buying Power Initiative and the impetus that that has given to what Dave referred to as not just robust competition, but relentless competition. So yeah, the money is a problem, and it has exactly the three layers of dimension that you described. But actually, what featured in his conversation was more about how the customer is changing in terms of what it wants and how it wants to buy it.
I find the platform model particularly interesting because conceptually it makes a tremendous amount of sense. Execution has been a little more elusive because the two major platform procurements that I think of are F-35 and LCS. And each of them has some pretty significant, widely discussed issues. Problems may be unfair, but some big issues. Is it fair to assume that that's the direction, at least, that we'll see in the future, and that maybe the maybe the methodology that they're using now to develop those two particular programs will be changed, but the platform concept is here to stay?
Well, I think if by platform concept you mean the following, a lot of what the customer now wants is not a brand new clean sheet design of something. Indeed, they have expressly eschewed spending a lot of development monies on creating platforms that essentially, from a technology perspective, are really mature. Instead, what they want these system integrators to do is take a mature platform at the technology readiness level of 7, 8, or 9, if I can use a little jargon.
Sure.
And customize it,
mm-hmm.
and outfit it with the sensors and the communications packages and the other stuff that, you know, is accelerating at this 18-month cycle, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. That pattern, if that's what you mean, I think is here to stay. Practically ingrained at this point, even though some clean sheet designs like the F-35 maybe distract our attention from these other trends that are going on. LCS, by contrast, is exactly a program like that, right? The two ships, the basic hulls that competed in that program were a catamaran ferry from Australia and an Italian yacht. Right, the basic platform, which then the system integrator needed to bring and customize and outfit with the electronics and sensors and communications that made the thing most useful to the customer. That trend is for real.
And there's no reason to think that the way that the F-35 is built, when that plane becomes regarded as a success, that it can be customized.
Absolutely.
30 years from now or 50 years from now. Or whatever, because of the modularity that's built into the program.
Absolutely, and indeed, I think already you're seeing, as that program propagates its way out among the international partners, you're already seeing a customization.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that customization, I dare say, is even dumbing down a little bit the capabilities and the technologies that are embedded in the U.S. Version of that, but even so, that's being good at that. Getting really good at customization is going to become a real basis of competition. Again, if it isn't already, but it's going to become a basis of competition in the future.
You mentioned mergers and acquisitions, and we've heard Ashton Carter and Frank Kendall talk about the desire to maintain a level of competition within the defense industrial base. Their position is that they have a role in shaping what the DIB looks like. How far can that go when you have private sector companies that have the right, if they choose to do so, to get together or separate or buy one another or whatever?
Mm-hmm. I guess a couple things I would say about that. I think Ash Carter and Frank Kendall have been fairly careful actually about exactly what they have said there. In other words, I think a lot of the reportage of what they have said around mergers and acquisitions have made some extrapolations to the extent of, indeed, one of the reporters at the event we held this morning said words to the effect, have a policy against big mergers. That isn't true to what they've actually said, first. But at the same time, would I think it fair to say they have largely discouraged big mergers? Yeah, I think that would be fair to say. As a practical matter, it's important to remember they need to be discreet about the way they send these signals, because as a practical matter, there is only the club of antitrust policy strictly that they have to wield against a merger that they may find for their purposes unsuited to, you know, the industrial policy that they want to pursue, which isn't to say that they don't have some powers of persuasion as the customer, but they do need to be careful as to how far out on a limb they take themselves, knowing that it's really the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission who ultimately have the government's authority over whether a private commercial firm is going to be permitted to merge with another private commercial firm or not.
When you went into your event this morning, what were you thinking about as the strategic challenges that the Defense Department's facing right now, and how did Mr. Melcher's comments either confirm or change what your thoughts were about that?
I have one thought that has been in my mind for about 5 years, and that is I describe as what to do with the cash.
Mm-hmm.
Dave talked about that, and that is to say, you know, for several years now, right from the peak of defense spending, even up to today, defense companies have been generating lots of cash. And most of, and you know, in some sense, the central strategic choice that any company makes is what to do with the cash that it generates. And most of, and Dave talked about this, what the defense industry to generalize has been doing is giving that cash back to their shareholders in different ways. Well, that strategy, you know, can't go on forever. And at some point, the companies are going to have to figure out how to invest in the actual business they run, not just invest to some extent to prop up their share prices. And Dave signaled that, you know, that hasn't been particularly a strategy in his company, which has a peculiar, need for cash in its pension fund. But it is a trend in the defense industry that Dave remarked, you know, can't run forever. Which leads to the other big strategic challenge that is on my mind, which I have said less about and don't have quite as cute a caption over, and that is innovation. I mean, essentially, in my view, you know, corporate strategy in this sense is about one of two things: how to restructure what you got, change the portfolio of things you have, or how to innovate in respect to the products and services that you're already vending, or somehow innovate the relationship you have with customers. He spoke to that, spoke to how Excellus is trying to invest in the innovation of its own service offerings and product offerings, but said less about that, to be mm-hmm. honest with you. And in general, if I may suggest, this is a topic that I would like to see the captains of the defense industry talking a lot more about, which is how are they going to innovate the products and services that will give them competitive advantage to succeed over the competitors.
Well, let's pick up on that concept of innovation when we come back. My guest is Steve Grundman. He is a principal at Grundman Advisory and the Lund Fellow at the Atlantic Council. And my conversation with Steve will continue in just a moment on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Steve Grundman is the Lund Fellow at the Atlantic Council and principal at Grundman Advisory and my guest on Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio. You mentioned innovation at the Pentagon, Steve, and this is maybe a little bit of a bone of contention in the defense industrial base right now, not at the very highest levels at the weapons system level, but below that as vendors try to figure out what, and it's not fair to pick on the Pentagon. This is an issue across the civilian agencies, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But vendors are trying to figure out what exactly the agencies mean by innovation. It's a little trickier at the Pentagon, though, because the industry is convinced, rightfully or not, that no matter what they demonstrate to the Pentagon, it's going to be judged on LPTA.
Right.
And somebody else can decide whether that's a valid perception or not, but that's the perception that people have. Given all of that, what is your view of the state of innovation today, and what would you say the Pentagon could do to demonstrate, maybe to give better parameters for what innovation they'd like to see, and to give maybe some comfort to the vendor community that if they demonstrate it, even if it's a little bit more expensive than what the cheapest thing would be, they still have a shot.
Okay. That's a big basket of stuff.
Let me
take a couple pieces of that. So one thing to be said for sure is that what it means to innovate in, let's say, aerospace and defense, for what it's worth, is changing. And it's a lot less about inventing, and it's a lot more about, I'm going to use the word again, customization. That is to say, it's a lot less about developing a mousetrap that didn't exist before, and a lot more about changing the relationship between the end user and the thing. You know, in most simple terms, maybe making it cheaper so they can buy a lot of them rather than a few of them. But also changing the way they access it, changing the way they use it. And I think it also has to be said that that different kind of innovation, which is much more prevalent in the commercial markets, is kind of hard for the aerospace and defense industry. The aerospace and defense industry is an industry whose legacy is to invent things, is to create rockets that didn't exist before and make airplanes that do things that the laws of physics weren't supposed to allow, et cetera. And so an industry that a customer now that wants a different kind of innovation is actually a challenge for this industry in many ways.
That concept of saying wow when you pull the curtain back is maybe the industry perception then of innovation. Is that what you're saying? And so the transition to a different kind of wow, or a wow at a different point in the transaction,
right,
is what they're looking at. Is that fair to say?
Yes, exactly. Okay. I mean, maybe if I can play with the analog here, it's not pulling back the curtain and saying wow. It's a soldier out in a foxhole pushing a button and saying, gee, mm-hmm. you know, all of this fusion came together, and I can make a fast decision now, which is not the sense of invention that I think inspires a lot of aerospace engineers,
right,
for example. I will also go so far, just working through this basket, mm-hmm. To say that, and come around to public policy that might promote it, that I think an economist would say that the market for innovation in defense is suffering market failure. And that is to say, in short, right, the risks and rewards are not symmetrical enough to generate an efficient quantity of innovation. And so, and this is particularly stark because I guess I would, you know, to be quick about it, companies are more risk averse than an efficient allocation, if you will, of resources to innovation should allow. And the rewards that the customer, the Pentagon, permits for innovation are too cheap. Basically, you can't make enough money mm-hmm. To take big bets on innovation in the defense market. And that gap, that chasm between this risk-averse customer, right, who's not going to spend money inventing something that they're not sure the customer is going to buy, and a customer who, when they do buy things, are buying them on, you know, 4%, 5%, and 6% job profit, is going to have to get bridged before we get some kind of a renaissance of innovation in the defense market.
So my takeaway then from what you're saying is that innovation becomes more when you talk about customization, my thought about that is an innovative vendor is going to be the one that can say, you know what, we can make that do this that you've never been able to do before,
right?
Rather than, as I said before, you pull the curtain back and this big new thing rolls out and everybody goes, wow, yeah, we've never seen anything like it.
I mean, you know, I think the great innovations, and now I'm going to set myself up for an example that's not quickly at hand, but the great innovations of the last couple of years have been these fusions.
Mm-hmm.
JDAM, the Joint Direct Attack Munition from the 90s, was not an invention. It was the fusion of a bomb and a seeker and a guidance package that was all off the shelf that a bunch of guys out at, I think, China Lake Labs with some contractors put together and said, bang, look at this.
Well, and that's the example that Jack Gansler always uses for an ideal procurement, too, because of that, because of the nature of the program, it was, he says it had three requirements. They were able to meet all three, and that was pretty much it.
Right.
It had to hit the target price point and it had to work, and that was much it.
So, albeit an old, you know, now a 15-year-old or older, for that matter, example, it's a good one of what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing whiz-bang about any of the individual technologies that went into that solution, but in short order, at cheap price, using off-the-shelf technologies, they solved a problem that couldn't otherwise be solved.
So, policy-wise, how do we get to more of those and fewer of some of the things that we've seen that have not worked that well?
Wouldn't it be great if I knew the answer to that?
Well, one of the things that I wonder if is a component of that is incentive realignment. You talked about incentives.
Absolutely.
How do you restructure the incentives? If you're not going to go and rewrite DFAR, then how do you change the incentive structure so that you get to what you're talking about where it's an industry goes, I'm going to see some potential reward for this risk.
Right.
And so I'm willing to stretch that a little bit because the reward might be there for me.
The only short answer to that I know is there's got to be more reward for taking that risk. So as a matter of government policy, there have got to be some things for which we're willing to richly, I have no qualms about saying that, richly reward a contractor for having put up its money to solve a problem without the government having had to finance it. Because, the model of innovation we have today is no substantial risk on the part of the contractor. The government takes all the risk. We'll give you the money. You do your best and invent the thing. And now, you know, the customer is saying, I ain't got that much money for concept development and all these far upstream risks. You take that risk. Well, okay. But the contractors have to have a bigger reward on the other end if they're going to be able to, you know, justify to their shareholders why to take some of that cash I referred to and put it into an investment inside the company rather than give it back as a share repurchase or something like that.
Well, and it strikes me too that, for example, in the commercial aircraft sector, the airlines didn't go to Boeing and say, we want you to build a whole new aircraft, so we'll subsidize your research and development for the 767.
Right.
Boeing said, we anticipate a customer need, and so we're going to develop this product. And they developed it, and people said, yeah, we'll take some of those.
Yeah.
Do I have the model right?
You've got it. Actually, let me underscore it. A completely different model, a completely different business model. Mm-hmm. The economics of which are completely different. Something to importantly understand is that the defense and the aerospace, the commercial aerospace markets, which kind of work side by side together in one's mind, have completely different business models on that dimension.
Mm-hmm. And so how can the government then set policy so as to maybe try to bend those business models, because that's certainly a much more appealing business model for them. Maybe not so much for the vendor, but, I mean, we certainly had the 767 has competitors.
Yeah.
And there's enough of a base there for those, enough other companies are able to do business around the world to be able to justify the R&D that they're doing for the models that they're selling that compete.
So I will, modestly offer one suggestion, and that is keep working away from cost-based contracting and get, and do serious, authentic fixed price contracting. The reason I underscore authentic and serious is that a lot of what the government calls fixed price contracting really isn't. It still is subject to cost accounting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to incentivize guys to take a chance on being able to make a lot of money, the Pentagon, let's say, the ministries have to become authentic commercial buyers, which means they buy on price. They really buy on price. They get no insight into the cost basis of the price that they're paying. That would help, right? Because then the contractors could say, all right, I can work this. If I don't have to expose and justify my price on cost, I will work this problem where I can make a lot of money by taking, you know, and thereby justify the risk that I'm taking to make this big investment.
We're only about a third of the way into the questions I wanted to talk to you about today, Stephen. We're out of time. It's great to have you here. Thanks for coming in today. Congratulations on this event. You have this is the first of a series, right?
It is the first of what we hope will be a really successful series of chief executive officers, the captains of industries, coming to talk about the public interests that they serve and the public policies that shape their markets. I'm also going to throw in a little plug for the blog that we have launched this week as well. It's called The Defense Industrialist, and it's available at AtlanticCouncil.org. And it's right on these topics that we've just spent a half hour talking about.
And I'm happy to put a link to that later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, along with our conversation. Steve, it's great to have you here. Thank you very much for coming in. Steve Grundman is the Lund Fellow at the Atlantic Council. And he is principal at Grundman Advisory, and you can find those resources I mentioned later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.